Good evening, everybody. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Do good to those who harm you. I grew up learning those words of Jesus Christ. Are they familiar to some of you, those words? I learned them in church and Sunday school. I've been blessed with a life that has not exposed me to the level of harm, danger, or enmity that is so pervasive in many parts of the world and in our own society for some. And yet I have experienced being seen as other, and I've been hurt and felt excluded. Probably each one of us has in some way, or most of us, if not all. And I have undoubtedly hurt others, shutting them out of my heart and mind, whether deliberately, out of fear or confusion, or inadvertently, out of ignorance. And each of us here has probably done that too, you know, shut others out of our heart and mind. As we realized in our discussions of conflict this past week, and with Michael and with Vicky, our Shuso, and talking about right speech earlier, we realized that the need to protect ourselves from what we perceive as external threat is deeply ingrained in our human psyche, in our neurobiology. Last week, Michael suggested that we take up the practice of bringing awareness to those feelings of threat when they arise in us, and that reflex to treat the source of perceived threat as somehow other to us. Even if we're not living in a war zone, it's so easy for the mind of enmity to arise, to make an enemy out of our neighbor or our work colleague or spouse or our teenager. Now you might say, oh, I don't have enemies. You might think that's too strong a word. But in that moment that the urge arises to strike back, if not literally, verbally, or to run away or to freeze, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, in that moment that arises, we see the other as a threat to our physical safety or our identity, our pride, our family or possessions, our values, our beliefs. You know, whatever we identify with as me and mine, it does become a matter of me versus them, us versus them. That's the mind of enmity. It's not so easy to keep our hearts and minds open to those who we perceive as posing a threat to ourselves and all that we identify with. It's so easy for that mind of enmity to arise. And it has caused us humans untold suffering. No wonder the teachings of the world's spiritual traditions put loving one's enemy high on the list of precepts. In the Dhammapada, which is one of the earliest Buddhist texts, the Buddha says, "He was angry with me. He attacked me. She defeated me. She robbed me. Those who dwell on such thoughts will never be free from hatred. He was angry with me. He attacked me. She defeated me. She robbed me. Those who do not dwell on such thoughts will surely be free from hatred. For hatred can never put an end to hatred. Love alone can." Here's a simple example that's literally close to home for me. As most of you know, some of you know, Michael and I moved out to the countryside between Maple Ridge and Mission 12 years ago to a couple of acres surrounded by forest, backing on a wetland, which means that over the years we've seen over 60 species of birds right there. Those chickadees and Steller's jays and ravens, flickers, great blue herons, barred owls are my neighbors. I feel them as my neighbors and friends. Now, over those years, our human neighbors on all sides have been cutting down trees. On one side, they cut their back acre to put down countless dump truck loads of fill to create horse paddocks. On the other side, another neighbor cut through an old beaver dam that made a pond where ducks used to come. And the other neighbor stripped all the brush from around that little creek that flows through the pond. And across the road, a 10-acre wooded lot has been subdivided into four, and each new resident has cut down more and more trees. These are 70 to 100-year-old second-growth red cedars, western hemlocks, and Douglas firs. And when they crash to the earth, they shake our house. Feels like an earthquake when those big trees come down. And my heart quakes every time. In the first 5 years or so, we saw sapsuckers, nuthatches, downy and hairy woodpeckers. They're all birds that live in hollow holes in trees. And we've seen fewer and fewer of them over the years. And I miss them. I miss them like dear friends. When I hear a chainsaw start up again, sometimes a flash of anger, almost indistinguishable from grief and pain, will arise in me. And then the anger quickly fades, but the grief and pain fade less quickly, leaving not hatred, but sadness and loneliness. And that's a feeling of disconnection from my fellow human beings. And it's familiar to me. I grew up in a rural, small town environment feeling different from those around me and their values. As with our, and I have actually talked to a couple of those neighbors. And I have a better sense of who they are and what their values are and how they are different from me. And I feel a kind of sad spaciousness around that difference. As with all our views and in general, our perceptions of those who are different from us are conditioned, right? They're conditioned by our experiences, growing up, by the attitudes of our family, from attitudes in society around us. And we may adopt those same attitudes or we may question and reject them, but we can't help but being influenced by them, by the conditioning factors around us. So I'd like to invite you just to take a few moments to close your eyes and just reflect back. Let your mind travel back in time to an early memory, might not be the earliest, but an early memory of encountering difference. Often when we're little, it's not articulated in words. It's often just a feeling level of perhaps uneasiness, maybe going to a friend's house for the first time and encountering different foods, different parental behaviors or household standards from what you were used to in your own family. Or it might have been meeting a person or people of another race or culture or language for the first time. Or it might be going to the city or to the country for the first time, realizing there's another whole different way of living out there from what you had known. Or perhaps to the wilderness for the first time, encountering the wild, encountering unknown plants and animals. So take a moment to just recall some experience of encountering the unfamiliar, the different. And recall specific details, sensory impressions. And how did you feel? Anxiety, curiosity, excitement, fear? Just recall any details. Okay, thank you for trying that. We are shaped by our experiences. And so part of our practice is, of course, to see that, but to realize that what we know and what we experience is always partial and subject to change. And so sometimes we have later experiences that shift or open up an earlier experience. So that's another thing to think about in your own experience. Has there been a shift in your relationship to a particular kind of encounter with difference? Much of the enmity in the world seems to center on the kind of tribalism we call race. Many of us learned growing up that there are four human races. There was a song that I learned in Sunday school, and it went, Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. So there was fairly early on some cognitive dissonance for me. If that was true, it didn't seem to make much difference to the way some children were treated in my very own society. My first conscious awareness of prejudice and injustice was of racism in my own small-town Baptist church, and in a church-led expedition with Thanksgiving or Christmas baskets to the slums of Newark, New Jersey, which were some of the very worst slums in the United States at that time. And then there were marches, race riots, paranoia in my small town, they might come here. And Martin Luther King's assassination. And all these decades later, black lives still don't matter in the same way that white lives do. How many generations does it take to heal the karmic legacy of slavery, violence, and trauma? When I left my country because of the racist war in Vietnam, I arrived in Canada at the height of the War Measures Act invoked by Pierre Trudeau in response to the FLQ. And I was baffled at first by the depth of animosity and conflict between two white peoples, the French and the English. I was quite ignorant of the ancient twisted karma of that relationship. I just didn't get it initially. Now, the word race apparently was originally used to refer more to language and ethnic and national difference, and only in the 18th century came to be used as a so-called scientific classification based on supposed biological differences into the various divisions. There have been various variations on those divisions, but the most common are the four we know as Negroid, Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and American Indian, red and yellow, black and white. And scientific rationales were given for these races to be seen as primordial, natural, enduring, and distinct, quite distinct. But in recent years, genetic research has suggested that that conception of race is just that, a construct. Just a construct, and that genetic differences among groups are basically biologically meaningless. That we are so close genetically, and that there's more genetic variation within race, within racial categories than between, and that racial traits overlap. There are no discrete boundaries. So in Buddhist terms, we can say that the concept of race is ultimately empty. We can look deeply into human greed, hatred, and delusion and see that no category of human being is immune to those three poisons. Right? Those are human. Human habit patterns. And that to demonize or to act from the mind of enmity on the basis of tribal mentality is a human habit pattern. Some of the most long-standing and destructive conflicts in the world are between racially and ethnically very similar peoples, divided by religion. Look at the Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland, or the Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Muslims, or the Hindus and Muslims in India and Pakistan. Look at the Tutsis and Hutus in Rwanda, where the very just subtle cultural and ethnic differences. Or differences based on power, class, and education. Look at the Cambodian genocide. So difficult to understand. Many of these horrific conflicts have been complicated or even incited by colonial divide and conquer strategies. So we have to look as clearly and honestly as we can at these legacies and allow for a tremendous amount of complexity. Truth and reconciliation requires very open minds, able to hold that incredible complexity, and very open hearts to be able to see and feel the deep tangled roots of pain and loss, anger and confusion, and ultimately yearning for connection. I think that yearning for connection often gets buried beneath generations of bitter grudges, and yet there is a yearning for healing in each of those conflicts, surely. And yet despite all that, there have been times on this earth when societies with quite a great degree of diversity have lived successfully in close proximity. Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived in Southern Europe for several centuries in the, I have to check my facts, but I'm going to say the 12, 1300s, with a great deal of creativity, great flowering of music and culture, and inter-pollination, cross-pollinization. I've been interested in what makes individuals go against the grain of their society's prejudices, and to love and care for those who are seen as different or the enemy, or in some way lesser, inferior. And let's include with this the plant and animal communities that we have, that we treat as other or lesser. What makes some individuals able to keep their hearts open, even after having been grievously harmed, to refuse the mind of enmity? So I've been doing some reading during this practice period, since from childhood reading has been a window to the world for me when I haven't been in a position to go out into the world always. And reading, of course, is limited. It's removed from direct experience. But as humans, we are creatures of language and creativity, and language is powerful. So reading the words and the stories and poems and listening to the music of those who are different from us is one way to open our hearts and minds. I'm sure you've all done that. So one of my readings was a book called I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey by Dr. Izzeldin Abolaish. He is a Palestinian obstetrician gynecologist and a public health expert who now lives in Toronto. He was born and raised in a refugee settlement on the Gaza Strip, and his early years were characterized by hardship, poverty, struggle to get an education. And yet, almost miraculously, he grew up free from hatred of the Israelis, despite repeated incidents of persecution. A key formative experience for him was working for an Israeli farm family when he was in high school, who treated him with decency and kindness and actually encouraged him not to quit school and to stay with his and to become educated, at a time when he was sort of facing adolescent despair and discouragement. And he went on to form strong Israeli friendships and alliances in the medical world, people who joined with him in a strong commitment to speak out for peace and reconciliation. And he became a well-known figure until one day Israeli mortar fire hit his home on the Gaza and killed three of his daughters and his niece. He had two other daughters and two sons, but he lost three daughters in those short moments. I'd like to share a few of his words with you. So notice the title, I Shall Not Hate. He talks about the Israelis and the Palestinians, and he says, it is quite astonishing to realize how similar our two peoples are in the way we raise our children, in the importance of family and extended family, and in the animated style with which we like to tell stories. We're argumentative, expressive, emotional people. We come from the Semitic religions and languages. We have many more similarities than differences, and yet for 60 years, we haven't been able to bridge the divide between us. We One of the ways to alter the status quo is to look to the women and girls. It's easy to find 1,000 men in favor of war. It's difficult to find 5 women who are inclined that way. I feel it's time to empower Palestinian women and girls, to give them respect and independence and let them take the lead. Too many girls cannot get an education because of financial and cultural considerations. Too many families with limited resources give chances only to their sons, even though their daughters are also serious and committed. So he now has a foundation called Daughters for Life, which gives scholarships for young women from the Middle East, regardless of religion or nationality, to come and study in the West. I was just on there looking at their website and looking at these, you know, beautiful, smart, ambitious young women. After his daughters were killed, he said the cries for reprisals didn't stop. What about the soldier who fired the deadly volleys from the tank? Didn't I hate him? But that's how the system works here. We use hatred and blame to avoid the reality that eventually we need to come together. As for the soldier who shelled my house, I believe in his conscience he has already punished himself, that he is asking himself, what have I done? And even if he doesn't think that now, tomorrow he will be a father. He will suffer for his actions when he sees how precious is the life of his child. To those who seek retaliation, I say, even if I got revenge on all the Israeli people, would it bring back my daughters? Hatred is an illness. It prevents healing and peace. So here are the words of a Palestinian Muslim echoing the words of the Buddha. Hatred cannot put an end to hatred. Only love can. Only connection. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha also said, let us live in joy, never hating those who hate us. Let us live in freedom, without hatred, even among those who hate. Conquest breeds hatred, for the conquered live in sorrow. Let us be neither conqueror nor conquered, and live in peace and joy. So our practice as bodhisattvas is to shine the light of awareness on our own feelings and thoughts. When the mind of enmity arises, to see deeply into the causes and conditions that shaped it, to see the emptiness of those thoughts and feelings. And by emptiness, I mean that they are subject to change, conditioned, partial, never the whole picture, never the whole picture. So when that mind of enmity arises, we release our grip. As Uchiyama Roshi, the great Japanese teacher Uchiyama Roshi said, we open the hand of thought, release our grip. And in so doing, we open our hearts to connection across difference. How do we nurture, how do we feel connection across difference? In the smallest ways, in the smallest ways, just in our daily interactions as we go to the store, go to the grocery store, making eye contact with the person at the till or the stranger on the street. We can practice this all the time in the smallest little ways. So then when the big enmities arise, we have some practice under our belts and we can breathe and open the hand, and open our hearts. So I'll stop now because I want to give you a chance to speak just for a few minutes with each other.